Yeah, I see you. 1-2-1-2, this is your boy, Malcolm Riddle. Another episode of American Riddle. I'm sitting here in studio today. That's right, you heard it. She's over here cracking up. No, it's not Miriam Tazi. She's off today. It's Antoinette Lendragon. Is that close?
Close enough.
Huh? Speak into that mic. Let the world hear you.
Close enough.
All right. Antoinette. So we're sitting here actually broadcasting from a remote location way down in Gainesville, Virginia. I feel like I'm hunched over. All right. Let me adjust my mic here. There we go. Listen to a little Jim Morrison. You like Jim?
Yeah. He's good.
You like him?
He was.
Still is.
Well.
He's a lizard king. So yeah, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Let me turn that down a bit so I can hear myself. Thank you. You see, it's unconventional up in this camp, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you smiling? You like this setup, don't you?
It's awesome.
It is awesome.
It's very professional.
I am happy that you've decided to join this little program. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in, because this is a real treat for me. Antoinette is the owner of a wine shop here in Gainesville, Virginia, called the Cork and Fork. And that's where we're broadcasting from. So, mm-hmm. Awesome location. We'll post a picture of the setup. Sipping on a little rosé today.
That's right.
Yeah.
We do it with style.
You do it in style. With Jim Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
If he was here, he would have a drink.
Or two.
Yeah. Or three.
Five.
Oh, or five. You know Jim, huh? How do you know Jim?
We go way back.
Really?
Yeah, I don't want to brag, but yeah.
You're nervous, huh?
A little bit.
Relax. It's not like we're live right now in front of an audience. Or I even have a large audience, but... so we're sipping on, let me turn this down a little bit, Soul Kitchen by The Doors, people. Download it. Pay for it. Don't steal it. Enough of that. Let's get down to business. So we're sipping on a little, what is this? Is it Chateau? Miraval. Is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm. Miraval from Provence.
Provence. I like the way you say that.
Right.
Say it better than I say it. And this is the rosé. So this is a very famous chateau.
Right. It certainly is. It's owned by two very famous people.
They own it. So, meaning the famous people are Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who were the owners before? Because I know it has some history as far as in the entertainment community. Because I know Pink Floyd,
right.
Sade, and various other musicians that, have recorded. I guess there's a recording studio in the chateau. Were you aware of that?
I was not.
Yeah. No. I think I don't know if it still is, but... That was the history prior to Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie moving in. I know they rented it for a while, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Then they decided...
Well, they had to test it out to make sure it was up to par.
Yeah.
Then they bought it.
What do you mean up to par?
Who do they work with? They work with Perrin down there, the winemaker Perrin.
Got you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a solid rosé. It's good.
It's all over the place.
You like it?
I love it. I sold it before, once upon a time, when it first came out,
mm-hmm.
with the organization I was with, and an outfit I was with, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
A distribution company I was with.
I think we get it.
All right, so. Was. No longer with. Present.
Uh-huh.
Mm, you get it.
And we understand.
We got it.
Mm-hmm.
It's good.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Yep.
So, but yeah, it's nice. It's stacked everywhere, and it's...
Mm-hmm.
it's delightful, beautiful presentation.
Mm-hmm. It's true. The
good
color
fruit.
Is gorgeous.
Yeah. So it's nice. It's that time of year. It's a good time for rosé. However, I think rosé itself should and could be and consumed all year round, correct?
Correct.
Good food wine.
Absolutely.
I've always got to educate people about the rosé because they think it's a quote-unquote blush or they think it's white Zinfandel. I hear that pretty much every weekend.
It's an uphill battle, definitely.
It's... Drives me crazy.
Sure.
You know, even white Zin has its place. I was educating some people Friday night about white Zinfandel and you know, its place in history because it was the sweet wine when we first start drinking wine when we're, you know, whatever age you are, 15, 16, 17, you know. But, you know, when you first start drinking wine, you go for the sweet stuff, regardless of what age you're in. But, and the white Zin was the go-to wine from Beringer or Sutter, what is it, Sutter Home or whatever. But they used that money. They used that money to fund all their other you know, high-end wines. So you need it to exist for one form or another to exist when it comes to wine, because you just can't start out, you know, with these grand estates mm-hmm. without having the money to build right. those estates. So right. it was built on the backs of the white Zinfandel. But people, time and time again, they get confused when they see a really nice rosé and they think it's going to be sweet. Mm-hmm. I tell them it's not going to be sweet. It's bone dry. It's going to pair up nice. It's better than most Chardonnays that are overly oaked mm-hmm. Anyway in the market. So you can have something like this that's going to pair up with your seafood, fish, various dishes, with or without, you know, a meat of some sort. It's mm-hmm. perfect. Mm-hmm. You agree?
I agree completely.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Dominique, how are you, sir? Good, good. Dominique, Antoinette's father, also owner of the Cork and Fork, Washington, D.C. location. So we're just doing a broadcast podcast right
live?
Now. Yes, it's live in front of us, but the audience isn't going to listen until I post it. So.
Okay, welcome to everybody, good to see you, Malcolm.
Good to see you. Excellent. So, yeah, we're just going to have a conversation about wine and all sorts of good stuff. Yeah, I like it. I like a guest that pops in. You never know what's going to go on in this show called American Riddle. So,
Dad, you want to take
this? Oh, that's good. I like the play on words.
Yeah, yeah. It's a podcast I produce, and we talk about various things. I know I'm sweating. Now I'm really sweating because your dad walked in. Had no idea we're going to have an audience member. But here we are. You're drinking a little rosé for the people. Yes. The World Cup is on and people are out, and they're checking out what they should be checking out. It's amazing, the fanfare.
Mm-hmm. Hmm? Oh, yeah.
You see Absolutely. How I just ramble on and I just keep on going.
The fanfare is incredible. People were yelling in the streets earlier. Yeah,
it was a celebration.
In Gainesville.
You can't celebrate too early.
No.
Because you never know what's going to happen.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Especially with soccer. It's a great game.
Don't really get into it myself. I wish I was as enthusiastic as everyone else. I wish I was, but in sports in general, I don't watch a lot of sports.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I try.
Sure.
Try to keep up.
Yeah.
I catch it, you know, download and stuff like that.
Well, you're more of you like arts and film, correct?
I like arts and film, yes. I do. Very much so.
Right. Well, there you go.
Yeah. You're a little soft-spoken right now. See, Chatty Cathy earlier, now the cat's got your tongue. Loosen up, Antoinette. We're going to make this show. We're going to get on into it, have another couple drinks. If we need to take a break, we can take a commercial break. You just let me know which way you want to go. This is going up, regardless. It's going up. But yeah, tell the audience a little bit about your history in the wine game, and how you got into it. Where you're from, blah, 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 blah,
right.
all that good stuff.
Well, it's fairly simple. I was born into it. So and my father is from Champagne, France,
yeah.
and they've been making wine there. The family's been making wine for about 200, 300 years, and it was just a natural progression.
Your family?
Yeah.
That's a long time.
It is a very long time.
It's very historic.
Yep. So was born into it, and early on, Dad actually wanted me to study winemaking,
mm-hmm.
but that never happened. So when the stores opened, they brought me on about a year after Gainesville was open.
Is there a reason why you never got into the winemaking aspect of it?
I guess it was just something that living in the U.S., even though the family was very involved, obviously, with wine and winemaking. I was sort of detached from what it was. You know, had I grown up in France, for example, then it would have been a different story, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, the winemaking side is very technical. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's I try not to back myself into a wall when you have, you know, a winemaker conversation about making wine, just because there's a lot that goes into it. And, you know, me as a independent, as a consultant, I can sell the wine, but to tell you how it's actually made,
mm-hmm.
it's a
totally different game. And that's
yeah.
the thing. I mean, when you're a winemaker, you're studying so many different aspects of wine. I mean, definitely the scientific side of it, but you're also studying the earth and all the microclimates and everything like that. So
yeah.
for a salesperson to step in and say that they know everything about wine, I think, is a little bit overreaching.
There's a couple cats out there that know,
sure.
Or at least they think they know, and they can pull it off.
Exactly.
But someone who does know, they can read through it. Dominique, do you want to pair your headphones? I can get you a mic too if you want.
Yeah.
Do you want to get on?
Okay.
Yeah. Let me give me a quick second. Don't worry, I can clean this up and post.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I got the Line Dragons.
The team.
That's right.
The Cork and Folk team.
The awesome twosome. That's right. The dynamic duo. That's right. Yeah, be careful with the wine. Yeah, right in front might be better. It'll spill on the equipment, and then we're done. That's it. No mas. So be careful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The wine. So we're just talking about winemaking and the technique. Dominique, maybe you can share with the audience your background in wine. So Antoinette said she was born into it, a family, 300 years in the making.
Okay, so basically, can you hear me?
Get a little closer. Let's see.
Okay.
There you go. I got you.
No, basically, my family, they've been growing grapes in the same village for 250 years.
Wow. And that village is?
Grand Cru. A vineyard, a village in Champagne, and I would say that over time they learn how to adjust to the macroclimate and to the difficulties of the challenge of a cool situation where you have frost in the winter, you have rains in spring, and you have sometimes unpredictable sort of weather in late summer, early autumn, where you need really the perfect condition to get top quality. But on the other hand, it's important to understand that you learn from mistakes, you learn from experience, and unfortunately, every generation has to go through the process. But if you have the lack of some mentors in your family, people who are open and willing to explain to you what not to do,
yeah,
then you have a good chance to do basically nearly a perfect 10.
Hmm? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got to be, it's basically trying to find the best crop, you know, for that vintage.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also knowing, I had a discussion with someone this weekend about Virginia and Virginia wine and how a lot of quote-unquote wineries are doing it, but they're growing the grapes that aren't fit for this climate.
Mm-hmm.
It could be Sangiovese, it could be Pinot Noir, it could be whatever. And instead of sticking to what we know does well, like a Viognier or Cab Franc, mm-hmm. Norton, or whatever grape that is, they do these experiments, which the weather here isn't as consistent for grape growing or wine growing. So you have to know exactly what mm-hmm. your climate and soil is capable of, correct?
Well, it's complex because you may have a perfect condition for a certain type of wine, but the market may not be ready for it. For mm-hmm. example, I know in Virginia they can make some great late harvest, sweet Petit Manson, and even sweet Viognier. More or less, the market is going towards drier wines and towards blended complex wines. So if the grower is not ready for it, it's going to take him another 5 to 8 years to adjust. So that's where it's difficult. Huh?
Yeah.
On the other hand, also, you have people who want to appreciate good quality wine nearly every day. So you have to be competitive in terms of pricing. And not everybody is able to do that, because if you have a very small production unit, then your cost is very high, and then you need volume to be able really to have value.
Yeah, that's understanding the business.
So all this is really a lot of parameters that you have to be able to control.
Yeah. So you coming from a winemaking background, when did you first come here to the States?
Some 20 years ago, and basically it was an opportunity just to do some work in Virginia with a Frenchman who had properties in Madison County and in Napa Valley. And it was interesting in the sense that it was a novelty and it was a discovery sort of experience to realize that what could be done, what could not be done. And I've learned very quickly that basically Virginia is great for Chardonnay, for Viognier, for Cabernet Franc, and some specific grapes like Petit Manson to make some late harvest.
Yeah.
But otherwise, the difficulty was really to the gap that there is between the consumer. For example, in Washington, D.C., people don't know much about Virginia wine, and the producer. So there is still another 10, 15, 20 years really to work to reach out to the younger generations and maybe, obviously, to bring them to visit the vineyards as they do now, which is great, and then eventually to get more media sort of coverage like you do today, to be able really to tell people that there is something going on here. And if you look back to Washington State or Oregon, 30 years ago, nobody knew them much, and now really they're very successful because they found their niche. So this is really work in progress. I would be, it's very positive what we see because I could see at least a dozen of outstanding wines that are being produced now in Virginia.
Yeah, yeah. There's been some, and there's been a handful, I believe, that have won competitions around the world. There's some highly rated wineries. You coming from the winemaking background, you come here, I guess, 20-something years ago. Mm-hmm. How did you make the leap into the retail world, and what made you decide to make the leap into retail world from winemaking?
Well, in a sense, because we had a lot of experience in the grape growing, and then when we went to Australia, we had the experience of producing, and we were very much in contact with wholesale distributors and retailers, and in a sense, it was just completing the cycle or the circle.
So and you were in France and then Australia.
Yeah, France, Australia, and Virginia. And in a sense, what we regret is that ideally, if you are a good producer or want to be a good one, you need to have the experience of retail to understand exactly how people think. They don't think really that much, but first of all, they have a budget.
Yeah.
And then when you understand that, you realize that every day they want value, and on the weekend they're going to splurge, and then they will go for the very best, actually.
Yeah.
So you need at least two tiers of value and quality, and from then on, then you can build up because people want wine that are true to their sort of identity. So that means if you make Albarino or if you make Chardonnay or Viognier, make them exactly the way the grape is going to express itself. And when you go to the blending, then it becomes a sort of another dimension because what you want to do is to express really the extra quality that comes from having together like a soccer team. Or you have individuals that are together that one and one equal three, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good that you said that, you know, about knowing, having the history from one aspect of wine and the wine business and then applying that to another area. That way you understand the consumer. I think that's where a lot of people miss the mark is they really don't understand. They just think if they build something, it's going to come. You know, it's going to, you're going to magically just start selling wine. But it ultimately, anything in any retail, it's understanding your clients and understanding your people. Mm-hmm. That's the backbone. And that's something I've always stood for is the people that come into your establishment, the people that drive out of the way. I did a wine tasting this weekend, and people were driving all the way in from Maryland just for to taste this product that I was selling. Mm-hmm. So the people will come, you know, but they also know that there's a product that you have that meets their needs. Mm-hmm. It may not be your taste or my taste, but if you stand behind that product and you're representing it in the best way, then you're able to showcase it not only to the people that know it, but also introduce it to your clients, and that's important for a retailer. So you started the Cork and Fork with your family some years ago. How long ago was it when you? Because you have three stores, right?
Little five.
So and you started with one store,
and then in Virginia, and then in 08 we started in Maryland, and then in 2010 in DC.
So Washington, D.C., Maryland is Bethesda, Maryland, mm-hmm. and then here in Gainesville, Virginia, mm-hmm. the flagship store. And, you know, my hat's off to you because retail itself, it's a grind. And I've talked about it on this show before where, you know, you're in any establishment, you're in sun up to sundown. You know, and it's one of the hardest things that I found was finding the right people mm-hmm. to represent you when you're not there. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to open up another store, obviously you've recruited your family to help you out with that, which I think is smart, because who better to support you and your vision than your family, right?
Yeah, but eventually over time what you have is that some of your customers who are passionate volunteer to help you. And they become really your part-time sort of a team.
Yeah.
Because they don't have really they don't want to be full-time.
Yeah.
But they want to be there really because they love the product. And they are extrovert people. They enjoy socializing with customers. So then you have really a core of a team of people who are really knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
They have experience. And then they can really interact with your customer, which is really what they want, because they want to learn.
Yeah, and they're also part of the community. I had a shop a number of years ago, and I've had Tony Guida and Jeff Bryant. They've been on this podcast a number of times where we've talked about wines. And Tony would volunteer and work at my shop for free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, give him samples and stuff like that or whatever he wanted. But he would come in, and he would work the tasting bar. And not only that, he would bring his friends and tasting organization to the events, and they would drive out as far as D.C. and Maryland, mm-hmm. you know, just to support his friend, which was me, or is me. And it's an amazing relationship. You know, wine customers, the wine business itself, as big as it is, it's still a very small community mm-hmm. where everyone knows everyone, even in with our relationship. Me being a sales representative, we all kind of know each other, and we kind of know each other's habits and feed off of that. You know, it's very unique. It goes back to the people. I've said this a number of times on this show, where you like to do business with people that you like, that enjoy.
That you know and trust, yes.
Yeah, and also will show you the right things. You know, sometimes I might show you the wrong things, and you might shake your head at me like you did with Mangria, but it's no big deal because you know your clients,
mm-hmm.
you know?
That's right.
But Antoinette, of course, her store here in Gainesville, will embrace a different wine than in Washington D.C.
That's right.
So it's a cool thing to look at. What do you think, Antoinette? Just sitting there, get on the mic.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. The Mangria product is not something for every market, but it definitely works in Gainesville.
Yeah,
for sure.
And it's fun to find unique items. I'm sure there's items in D.C. Are there items in D.C.?
Well, like the Firmin from Tokay.
Yeah.
Everybody loved it, and we had a special sort of event a few days ago.
Yeah.
15 different types of grapes from 15 different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And people were blown away how interesting it was, because they were so significantly different from each other.
Yeah. And that's a unique varietal ferment from Tokay, because usually it's the key varietal for the sweeter wine,
mm-hmm.
the Tokay from Tokay, and this being a more dry wine, but really good fruit, very interesting characteristics in mm-hmm. it. So it's, I'm telling you, Hungarian wine is something I'm passionate about, but it's one of those hand sells.
That's right, because people really haven't visited that country, and they don't know really their specialty.
It's an old, very old winemaking or wine region itself, mm-hmm. as old as France, I believe, correct?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah, and I think during communism, I guess they weren't, I don't know if they weren't allowed, but they just didn't export. I mean, it was very limited. So it's, for me, representing the Kovash Nimrod line, K&W wines, it's always been an area where I'm selective about which, you know, retailers you put it in, because they have to know how to hand sell it. People aren't going to magically come in, you know, and wake up and like, oh, I got a party, I got to get ferment for the party. They would never do that.
Right.
You know, they're looking for Chardonnay or Merlot, but I like those obscure grapes like that. Are there any grapes that you like?
Well, in our 15 sort of selection, we had Fiano di Avellino, which mm-hmm. is from Italy. That was outstanding. We had Sauvignon Gris, which they used to call Tokay Friulano in Italy.
They had to change that name because of the Hungarian
That's right.
laws, I guess. The Hungarians were awarded the name Tokay.
That's right.
Right.
And
so
then we had Sauvignon Gris from Sauvignon Gris from Chile. We had the Albarino from Spain. And it was an interesting sort of a bracket, because The younger generation, they want really to appreciate things that are not Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc or even Cabernet. Or they want to go out of the box.
Yeah.
And I think that's a refreshing side of retail.
Yeah. Hmm? Yeah. I like that too. I mean, some of the wines I like, speaking on white wines, I like the wines from the Amalfi Coast, from Campania, Greco di Tufo. I like, of course, Gavi di Gavi. I like Falanghina. Some of these whites are very, very crisp, very clean, refreshing, and it's not the normal. I like Verdicchio a lot. How about you? What do you like, Andrew?
Good minerality. Anything that has good minerality in the acidity levels.
Yeah.
We had a Santorini, which was outstanding from Greece, and people really rediscovered it because the importers don't really push it.
What's the name of the grape?
That's a good question because you caught me on that one.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's been a handful of Greek wines that I wouldn't even begin to know how to explore or what the grapes are. But that region itself produces some wonderful wines, and there's a lot of forgotten areas that have some dynamic wines and personality out there, including here in Virginia. But if you find a good independent retailer for the listeners, you know, that's what you want to explore. See the stuff that's not the norm. I mean, how easy is it to get a Chardonnay? Mm-hmm. Or worse, when someone tells me, oh, I don't like Chardonnay. Really? You don't like Chardonnay? I mean, because there's so many different styles of Chardonnay, you know what I mean? If you get Burgundy or if you get something that's stainless steel, you know, it's amazing when I show someone something, oh, I don't like Chardonnay, and I'll pour something in a glass. Oh, I like that. Well, it's Chardonnay. What are you talking about? You don't like it. I mean, it's just not the big oaky, you know, quote-unquote buttery style that saturated the market, you know? And I get that all the time, and it ceases to amaze me how many times I get that. Same thing with reds. There's a lot of stuff that isn't ready to drink. You know what I mean? It's not even ready, and people are opening these bottles up, and they're sharp, they're young, they're tannic. Mm. You know, they're not balanced, and there's certain things. It's up to guys and girls like yourself, ladies, that are able to kind of educate your customers so they know, you know, how to handle the wines that they're getting. And, you know, when to open them, when not to, and even what's ready to drink now. It's I think it's an important dynamic of the wine business, especially the independent, because you guys are up against so many huge corporate wine giants out there, like Total Wine and places
Costco.
Like that. Yeah, Costco. Mm-hmm. They'll buy things right at, you know, and just set them at maybe 5 or 10% above cost. So how do you deal with that?
Well, basically, they tend to be predators because they would very often buy lots from importers of wine that even doesn't really move or sell.
Mm-hmm.
So they buy everything and then they sell it nearly at cost. So obviously the consumer who is not really educated feels that it's a great bargain, but the wine is not specifically interesting or outstanding.
Yeah.
So that's where there is a process for them really to realize to move on from basic entry level, into a wine that are really specifically quality.
I see that a lot with sparkling wine and champagne, where a lot of the big giants will set, like a Clicquot, right above what someone like yourself would get in wholesale. And that totally, I remember being so frustrated because I wanted to sell some of these beautiful wines from Champagne, but I couldn't compete with the margin, you know? Mm-hmm. So you have to find something else, you know? And it's something you have to deal with. You know, what are you going to do, you know?
Yeah, but they're mass produced, and you can find at the same price point
exactly
some champagne from independent producer that are amazingly better, more complex.
Yeah, I like that, and that's the fun of shopping. That's the fun of actually going in and meeting and getting to know your independent retailers in your establishment. I've dealt more with the Total Wines of the world this past year, and I've gone in and wow, it's amazing to see the selection they have in those places. If you know exactly what you want, I guess It's like going to Home Depot or something instead of your local hardware guy or something like that. You can go in there and headhunt and, you know, get the, you know, latest 93-point wine or whatever and stock up on that. But, you know, where it's at is back to what we talked about, getting to know the people, getting to know your retailer, and developing that relationship. That way you can find some of the cool stuff that's out there.
But basically, they have everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah.
So you need to be an expert, really, to do good shopping with them.
Yeah, you got to be on your, you got to, you know, have your thinking cap on and know exactly what you're getting into, because there's a lot of stuff out there. And like you said, there's some stuff that's just marked up just to move a volume of something.
Some wines are very ordinary. That's why a lot of our customers like to come here.
Yeah.
They say, I want a mixed case, and then Antoinette is going to select 12 different bottles. And they will come back because they know that 12 out of 12, they're going to be fine. But they say that when they go to Total, not everything is going to be fine.
Yeah.
So we are at a different level.
And it is interesting. We've definitely come across more and more customers that come in and sort of, if I can put it delicately, complain about the service they receive at the bigger box stores, because you're going in. The person doesn't know you. They don't remember your name. They don't remember what you bought last time. And here, at least, you know, we make the effort to really make that connection. So when you come back the third time, we should know you.
Yeah.
And we should know what you like and what you don't like. And I don't know, it's difficult for the employees at those big box stores as well, because there are so many products and they're not the buyers. So they're not tasting everything that comes in the door, whereas we have the opportunity to taste everything that we carry.
Yeah, it's personal. It's got that personalized touch to it. And that's, like I said, that's the backbone of any business. It's, you know, being a part of the community. Yeah, it's great. I think it's great that, you know, these communities, they throw them up and they throw in the Starbucks and stuff like that. But I kind of miss the local mom and pop deli. You know, I was talking about this the other day. I was like, I like the delis when they wrap the sandwich in the thick paper. You know what I mean? And it's a better quality bread. It's a better quality of meat. And, you know, it's all the way down to how they wrap it, the heavy paper. I don't know why, but I like that feel and getting to know the person behind the counter instead of, you know, I go to a Starbucks and it's the same as it would be in the next city. Next city and the next city. It's consistency. I know what they're doing. They're doing it not only in food, wine, they're doing it on the radio, they're doing it on television shows, where everything's just a carbon copy of a carbon copy and everyone's being fed the same thing. But isn't that the breakdown of community? Mm. Isn't it? You know what I mean? What makes a community special is how unique and different it is.
Right, individuality.
You know? Yeah, and if you go into, if I'm here in the Cork and Fork, in Gainesville, and I go to the one in D.C., it's a different look. There's a different style. That's
well, they are neighborhood wine shops. So yeah. Basically, people who live within 5 miles around us, they come to us because they're loyal. And in a sense, they appreciate the time we spend with them. And we don't hesitate to recommend things they don't know.
Yeah.
So then, obviously, the success is when they come back and they say, that one you gave me the other day was fantastic.
But the beauty of this experience, I would say, as a whole, is it's more about those personal relationships, as you were saying, because mm-hmm. it's very satisfying, I think, for a customer to come in and know that we will remember their name, what's happening at home, their children are growing up, what school they're going to, and it we are, in essence, mm-hmm. what is disappearing in retail.
Yeah. It's... And back to what I was saying also, the fact that you're here from sunup to sundown, right? Both of you. You know, it's how hard is it to find time for yourself to do other things outside of wine? Or is wine, you know, the end-all be-all? You know, is it always at work, always on call? You know, I know Antoinette works out a lot. She likes to run and she likes to do the marathons and stuff like that. I mean... is it easy to break away from your business so you can have downtime, you know, with the family or take vacations or even do more other wine stuff like go? I know I have a couple friends right now. They're over in Spain and in France right now and finding new wines and new stuff that they want to bring into their store. Do you get a lot of time off to do stuff like that?
Not anymore, in the sense because now we have such a great contact with our importers that they come to us, basically.
Good.
And they understand what we carry and what we select. So then they have this sort of perception of what we want to see.
Mm-hmm.
So every week, I would say, we see maybe 15 importers. We try certainly 100 wines, of which we select only 15%.
Yeah.
So obviously there is an 85% that is okay, but it's not really special.
Yeah. So that's a low margin. I mean, yeah, you have to make sure, from my side of the fence, you have to make sure your game's tight when you go to the store, because basically you'll try the wines, but it's got to be something that's going to be unique for that particular store.
Hmm?
You know, I sent Antoinette a couple pictures of some wines that I thought she should try in the future. Some of the Gerard Bertrand wines.
Oh, yes.
I know
they're
I'm pronouncing
good,
it wrong.
Very good.
Tell her. Tell
yeah,
her.
Actually,
she's here on the mic.
It's a good story because Gerard Bertrand used to be a rugbyman.
Yeah.
And for some reason, the wines reflect his sort of personality.
Uh-huh.
They are rich. They are full body. They are well constructed. They have a structure. They have complexity. They have flavor. It's really a success story. From the Languedoc.
I just, you know, I know you picked them up one time for this location. You asked me about them, but I just recently did a tasting with them and did the rosé, did the Tout Duval, did the Minervois, did the entire line, and I was blown away by them. At good value, also very good price point. I mean, most of them retail under 20 a bottle.
Great ratings too.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, yeah, 90 something points. I think he won Winery of the Year. I think in 2011.
They have a beautiful Crémant de Limoux, which is a sparkling wine with Chardonnay, Pinot Noir.
Amazing.
And a little bit of Chenin Blanc or Muscat.
Yeah, it's an amazing sparkler that they named after Thomas Jefferson. It's called the Jefferson Cuvée. And I guess they believed that Jefferson embodies everything it is to be French. And they knew he was very passionate, you know, about wine and winemaking and they named it the Thomas Jefferson Cuvée. So it's beautiful. It's a nice bottle.
I can't wait to try it.
It's on my list right now. I just put it on. I'll be bringing it by. So, just one of those unique things. And Antoinette, I know we've talked a couple times, more than a couple times offline, and watching your social media about outside of the wine business, where you participate in a lot of activities like marathons and ultra marathons. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about with you, which I'm sure it worries your dad to death about the...
Her mom.
Oh, yeah, about the marathons. I know you got it. When did you get into running and just during marathons? What was your first marathon?
Right. I think I started running about 5 or 6 years ago, and my first marathon was, 6 months after I started running initially, and it was just something that evolved from there.
I
did a half marathon first. I was pretty slow, so I went for a marathon. I was even slower, and I figured that if I wasn't going to do a sub-3-hour marathon, then I might as well try for distance.
You know,
if you're not fast, go long, right?
Yeah, and how many marathons have you participated in since you first got bitten by the bug?
Bitten by the bug. I've only done maybe 2 or 3 marathons. I've done more ultramarathons. So anything, I think the definition of ultramarathon is a little bit, there are two definitions. One is saying anything longer than a marathon. The other is saying it has to be a minimum of a 50K. But definitely done more ultras than actual marathons.
So what drives you? Like what drives you what inspires you, should I say, to do marathons or even an ultramarathon? Like I don't know many people who have done ultra marathons.
Have you done a marathon?
Never done one. I trained for one.
Right.
I trained for one before. I think the furthest or farthest?
Mm-hmm.
Which one is
either
it?
Or either.
Is it really? I think it's not. But I've trained, and I was training for one at one point in time. I was in a relationship, and the young lady I was with was into marathons and running and kind of inspired me. The things you do for love, right? It's amazing. And it's amazing. But that goes to the point of what your mind is capable of, how it controls your body, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Or can control if you want to.
Yeah, and it's amazing because my you know, I believed that I could do it. And I think that I went 9 miles at one time. I know I've done 7 in Red Mountain around in Washington State in 0-degree weather. Oh. I mean, just freezing weather. Insane. But, I mean, I was chasing love, I guess. But I still look back at that, and it's one of my fondest memories just because it shows you the positive that if you put your mind to it, regardless of what you're chasing, it could be for the medal, it could be just to say you can do something. Mm-hmm. You can apply that in business, you can apply that in any aspect of life. And that's why I'm fascinated, about what you do. Not just the marathon, but just in business itself when I'm talking to you two. Because there is a level of determination that I've seen over the course of time where you guys have stuck in there day after day after day and just, you know, grinding it out. You have hills, you have valleys, but, you know, the Land Dragons were always there. Always there. You know, the Cork and Fork is always there. And, you know, you're in it for the long haul. This is your marathon. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting to me, and it also motivates me. That's why you always see me come back. No matter where I was in my life or what obstacles I was doing, I still come back. And you'll see me, and it inspires me to do better when I'm around other people mm-hmm. that's actually doing it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's what I think you want. You want to surround yourself, you know, with other people that are doing something, that are moving somewhere, that are going somewhere. But I got to say, I'm really curious about what your mindset is like to go above and beyond. How many miles are in a marathon?
26.2. Wow.
And how many miles an ultra marathon is what?
So it's basically anything more than a marathon. But you can run as many miles as you want, right? So mm-hmm. 1,000 miles, 100 miles in between, that's an ultra.
That's amazing. I mean, that is something that I couldn't even imagine. I'd have to really be in love to do that. Could you imagine? Huh? It's also generational too. Like, I don't know many people that have even participated until you sent me that clip. What is this? The Barclay 100, right?
Correct.
Because nowadays I see a lot of young people out there, and they're doing what is it? Tough Mudders.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing zombie runs. They have all these really creative obstacles that they're doing, and it's not just the young. It's pretty much everyone has this. So it's not, you know, just a certain group of people, but so many people have been inspired to see how much their mind and body can take. It's not just physical,
right?
But it's mental.
Oh, it's very much mental. And like you talk to some of the older ultra runners in the community, and you have some amazing runners like Gary Nipling, who's going on 70, who runs 100 milers like it's going out of style. And he'll be the first to tell you that a 100-mile race is, you know, almost, as mental as physical, because at some point your body gives out and you really just have to push yourself to get to that finish line. And it's extraordinary. So age in this sport really has nothing to do with it. It's really what you're determined to do and how far you're willing to push yourself.
It really is. I mean, I look back at a lot of, you know, just when I work out and stuff. Like some days I'm distracted. Some days we were talking offline that I'm rushed. I have to get from one job to another or one place to another, but I try to fit the gym in. And you have to find that balance. You have to find that mental space to clear your mind and be able to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, on that end, I couldn't – at this point, like I can't imagine – the focus it would take to complete 100 miles. I know when you were telling me about it, and I'd be like, wow, you know, I couldn't. That's all you can say, right? I mean,
it's hard to comprehend if you're not really doing it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult, and you sent a clip to me. It's a short film, and it's entitled Barclay 100, and I always thought that you guys were like running around, like, you know, it could be a street, like a marathon. It's usually a section of a city, and they run like the LA Marathon or the Boston Marathon or something like that. But this is more of an obstacle. right? It's a course.
Well, the Barclay Marathon is definitely one of the most unique ultra marathons in the world. It's a course where it's in the woods or mountains of Tennessee, in Frozen Head State Park, and you go out there. There's a course. You get the map the night before, and you have to navigate via compass. And it's extremely difficult. It has an insane amount of vertical climb, gain and loss.
Yeah.
And the terrain is, it's 80%
mountains.
Off trail. Right.
It's mountains and wilderness and rain sometimes. Just the elements, right?
Correct. Yeah.
It's just beating you up.
It is. And there's a lot of just unknowns out there. And that's a beautiful part about the race, I think, is just not knowing where you're going to crack.
Now, is that something that you're training for now?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
So I basically would like to do it, but not for another couple of years, because it's something that I really think you need at least a solid, 12 to 16 months to condition your body for and get to the right spot. I'm not the in a place right now where I could do it tomorrow, let's say.
How long has that been around, the Barclay 100?
I think it's the first one was in 86, I believe.
Yeah. Let me play the clip real quick, the opening of this movie called Barclay 100. And it's, do you know the director, or how did you come across this film?
The film was done by one of the crews that were out there this past year, or in April when I was out there.
Gotcha. Let's just take a quick listen of the opening of this film real quick.
Eight years have passed since James Earl Ray began serving a 99-year prison sentence for the assassination of Dr. King.
Police with bloodhounds on the ground, helicopters in the air, all of them scouring a 5-square-mile area in the rugged Tennessee hill country around the maximum security Brushy Mountain Prison near Petros, Tennessee. The object of their manhunt, 6 convicts, including James Earl Ray.
Getting out of Brushy Mountain Prison is one thing. Others have done it. But getting out of Morgan County is something else. Brushy Mountain and neighboring Frozen Head rise up sharply behind the prison to 3,000 feet, and this is rough country.
When James Earl Ray escaped, and I'd been backpacking up here for years before that, so we watched it on TV like everyone else, and we were laughing at him only making 8.5 miles in 54 hours, and I said, in that length of time, I could have gone 100 miles, because I was young and cocky.
And all of it came together, and the Barclay was born.
So is that the gentleman that started?
Mm-hmm, Gary Cantrell, known as Lazarus Lake.
Yeah, and James Earl Ray, of course, is on the run after killing Martin Luther King Jr., and he's like, I could do 100 miles. I mean... Mm-hmm. And they do it, right? Because right now they're showing them climbing rocks on the clip. And this clip can be found, or this film, I guess it's what, a 20-minute film?
Mm-hmm.
Can be found on Vimeo, I believe. Is it open to the public?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so Barclay 100, you guys can look that up. I'll probably post a link on Facebook so you guys can have a direct link to it. But I found it to be a fascinating watch. I mean, just very, I was intrigued, but like I said, just fascinated by the fact that I thought, when you say 100 miles, your mind really can't process 100 miles.
Right.
You really can't, especially when you say marathon, because you're thinking a track of some sort. But this is through terrain.
So this particular race is through terrain, but it's important to remember that these races happen on all different terrains. So you do have ultramarathons. There's a 3-day ultramarathon in New Jersey where it's a 1-mile loop on road that people just run for 72 hours to see how far they can go. And I mean, people will run anywhere where there is surface, where animals that are really, meant to run. And Once you see it all the time. Once people start running a 5K, they want to do a 10K, and they just naturally want to evolve and get better and get faster. And there's something about it that just makes us feel good. So whatever it is that's inside of us that makes us want to run, you know, we kind of answer that call in a sense.
And how do you train for something like this?
Well, I mean, I can tell you how I train for, you know, like I have a race coming up next month. I can tell you how I trained for that. But I definitely can't tell you how to train for the Barclay because there are so few people that finished it. There are now, 14 people that finished it. So if I knew how to train it, I would have been one of the people finishing it this past year.
And what's the race again that you're training for?
So it's actually by the same race director. It's the last annual Vol State. It's across part of Tennessee. It's 500K. And he gives us 10 days to complete it.
500K?
Right, 314 miles.
Holy mackerel.
Right. But, and that's all on road, right?
Dominique is over here smiling like, oh my gosh, seriously?
Yeah.
And that's, how long does that take? Like how long, how does that even work?
Right. I mean, it's going to be definitely my longest distance by 114 miles. So I don't know where it's going to take me personally and how long it'll take me to finish. But the record times, I think it's about 80 miles for male, fastest male. And 120 for fastest female as we stand.
And so when you train for that, though, like how exact? What is the training? Because you take breaks, don't you? Do you sleep?
Exactly.
Are you worried of cramping? Like,
of course.
You know, all the, yes, everything.
Anything and everything can and probably will happen.
So you're preparing for that.
You're preparing. It's the best way to put it is you absolutely prepare for the worst. And it's not just physical. You prepare for the worst mentally as well. And it is, in a sense, like going off to war. You know there's a chance that something really serious and fatal might happen. And the same thing when you're running. You are expecting in the back of your mind that some really bad things can happen. And it could be just, a multitude of different things could go wrong. And it's up to you. It's the responsibility of the runner to stay on top of that and try and monitor yourself at all times and make sure that you're doing everything that you can possibly think of to keep yourself in a safe spot, right? So you can keep moving forward.
So when you train for something like this right now, are you... Do you do distance, obviously, some days shorter, some days longer, you know?
Right. I mean, everybody trains differently, so it's fair to say that. But me personally, I know that once I get out there, I can keep going. So my focus building up to these sorts of events is just to make myself as strong as possible so that, you know, I sort of build myself up so I can tear myself down when I'm out there.
Yeah. And the last training you did, you said you ran when, Saturday, was it?
I think it was Friday, maybe.
Friday.
Yeah.
Was that for distance?
Yeah, I may have done 30, something around
there.
Wow. Yeah. But, I mean, I'm still behind schedule on my training, but at this point it's too late to worry about it.
Yeah.
Just kinda...
Do you have to change up what you put in your body, the amount of fluids, the type of food, stuff like that?
During the training or the actual event?
Both.
Okay. Yeah. For training, it's just about, for me, it's just trying to stay as healthy as possible.
Yeah.
So you don't want to get injured or really bash your body down too much. And during the event, you just want to keep in a solid amount of calories every hour and hydration as much as possible, but not to overhydrate.
And do you have training partners to help, or even in the race, are there people that run with you or that are at pit stops? I mean, how does that work for safety?
Okay, so this race is, you have two options. There's the crewed, where you can have the support team, and the uncrewed, where you basically are with your backpack and you do the entire course on your own. I went for the crewed option. So, yeah, exactly. You know, there'll be, thanks to a very good friend of mine who helped me out with the vehicle, there's going to be an amazing vehicle where we'll have all of our supplies and a place to sleep. So basically that car will be with me at all times.
Yeah.
Or close to.
And it's got to worry you to death, right, Dominique? It's got
to. I think it should be okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's I could, like I said, it's hard to wrap your your mind around it if you haven't really pushed. Like, I've pushed myself to some extreme limits where people have looked at me. I used to spend a lot of time in the weight room. But, I mean, it's now these days when I've been invited many times from friends of mine to do Tough Mudder and stuff like that. And, you know, it's just I haven't really found that inspiration to push myself. And I know that mentally I haven't been in the right place. Like, I know what it takes mentally. And I know I've been up and down through hills and valleys, stress, working all the time and stuff like that. And just right there, me saying that, I've already talked myself out of it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You've already talked yourself out of it. So you've already failed before you even started because you're making excuses. Right. And this is recorded. This is me talking myself out of it. Until you make that commitment to take that step forward, it doesn't matter what it's in. It could be business. It could be anything. It could be anything in life. You'll always find yourself talking yourself out of it. Once you do that, you've already counted your first defeat. The key to it, I believe, is not talking yourself out and accepting the challenge and then moving forward. Mm-hmm. Just like with business. There are many people out there that say, oh, I'd like to have a wine shop, or I'd like to have a vineyard, or I'd like to do this, but I don't have enough time. I don't have enough time to work out. I don't have, you know, it's mm-hmm. always what you don't have.
Right. Yeah.
And it's funny because I've talked offline about you hear yourself with these headphones on, and just then I caught myself talking myself out of doing something like that. Because I have that same hunger and that same thirst to kind of see what I would do, see how I would perform. But it's so easy to talk yourself out of doing something. Mm-hmm. Talk yourself out of getting up in the morning. You don't feel like getting up. You don't feel like, you know, coming in. You call out for work. You know, you're late for work or whatever. People do it day in and day out. The key, I think, is not to talk yourself into it, mm-hmm. saying yes and stepping up to the challenge.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I would say that my experience with Cork and Fork actually helped me get into ultramarathon running, because when we moved locations here, you know, I was literally working like 6 a.m. to midnight, and mm-hmm. and just, you know, in comparison, once I ran my first 50 miler, it almost seemed easy in comparison to working as much as I did here. And in a sense, it showed me that you make things as big as you want them to be.
Yeah.
Right?
No, that's spot on. I mean, that's such is life, because we do it to ourselves day in and day out. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter what it is. It's we have the ability to do anything we dream of. But many times in life, we find ourselves making excuses not to do something. It could be anything, you know. It doesn't have to be in a marathon mm-hmm. or business related. It could just be with friendships that you have, or how you communicate, or any of that stuff. It's you know, being able to recognize that and, you know, make a move, execute. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you going to do today to be productive and to do something different, or to do something constructive, you know, with your life, and to benefit not just yourself but the others around you. And, you know, that's where my mind is at now, and I'm, you know, trying to keep that motivation going and move in that direction. And I, like I said, when I come here and I come into your business, I see that, and I find it inspirational, and that's why I wanted to, you know, sit down. It's a double plus that your dad, Dominique, came in because we're able to have a conversation, you know, about that. And other people that will listen will also see that. You know, one of the things that I like to do, and I've been, I don't know, what I've been talking to you about the podcast for the past almost year now, trying to get Nelly down. But it's fascinating to me, because it puts a light on the when someone else is listening. It's not just someone that's sitting behind a desk or in a shop, a retail establishment. The people that are there are more than that. They're human beings and personalities that have dreams, ambitions, and you do things that are interesting, like an ultra marathon or a marathon. Worked for hundreds of years of history in Champagne, France. Like, I mean, that speaks volume. To me, especially, it says a lot, and what you're doing, not just for yourself or your family, but also the community, mm-hmm. and how much you pay attention and care about the community that you're in. Mm-hmm. You know, you're able to bring something very unique and very different And I think people need to slow down just a bit look and recognize what's there, because in this society we're just constantly moving, and we're on our devices and looking at them and not really seeing the person in front of them. Mm-hmm. So that's why I like to, I've tried to have a handful of wine shop owners, just people in my world, on the show, and we've got, like I said, we've got a small, very small and loyal audience that listens to the program, and it's starting to grow. But I get feedback every week that I post the show, and it's very positive feedback and constructive many times. But they like what they hear.
Well, you do a good job.
Thank you. You've tuned in, huh? Listen to bits and pieces, right?
Well, the intro, at least.
Yeah. The intros are fun. I mean, they go on. Like this one, we're on almost an hour. But it's an hour of, I think, very informative information that people can learn from. And I like to have these conversations where it doesn't just, it's some wine, some about the marathon. Sometimes I go off and talk about, inspirational stuff or movies or whatever. Mm-hmm. But there's no script.
Right.
I don't like scripts. Although I would like to, at some point, maybe have a not really a scripted, but some sort of maybe play-by-play. But it's more fun, I think, to be natural. Mm-hmm. And I think the audience likes that.
And you do it well.
Do I? Thank you. That's very nice.
Spontaneous. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's not often I get a compliment from Antoinette. But okay, she has a way of giving a compliment, but then a few seconds later she'll...
Taking it back.
Oh, yeah. She's good at that. But, I think we've learned a lot. I think that we've covered a lot. And most importantly, I think we've introduced, through the American Riddle family, another family that I think is very inspirational, as I said before. Some exciting stuff on the horizon. And when can we follow back up with you about your marathon? You said it's coming up, right?
Yeah. So I should be back to Virginia by the 20th of July. Around there,
we have to do a recap.
A recap,
see how you did. You know, wait a week or so, let you recoup.
Mm-hmm,
huh?
Mm-hmm.
You're thinking about that, huh?
I am. It's gonna be.
Might take me another year to nail you down for an interview.
It'll be an interesting time, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, no, we wish you the best on that, Dominique.
Thank you.
I appreciate
you. Thank you very much for
joining us.
We really appreciate.
Yeah,
your,
and for those of you
support.
Guys, yeah, thank you, and likewise too. I appreciate your support, Dominique. Yeah, you know what I mean, Antoinette. Yeah, you guys support me, right? I'll buy some wine here and there sometimes.
Every once in a while.
Yeah, you know. So if I have something good to show, I'll work on that. But, thanks. Thank you guys for tuning in. Definitely look up the Cork and Fork. How can they find you? You guys are on Twitter, Facebook, anything like that?
All of the above.
Really? Mm-hmm. How can they find you on Twitter? You know what
the... Cork and Fork. Yeah. VADCMD.
Any websites or anything like that?
CorkandFork.com.
Easy to find.
Very easy.
Yeah, so Cork and Fork, you guys tuning in. Support your local retailers, like the Cork and Fork, especially in Washington, D.C., Bethesda, and Gainesville, VA. Follow them on Twitter, and I will post some links about this short film, and we will keep up with Antoinette's progress and her insanity.
And we'll also follow up on your next marathon adventure.
I need to, yeah. I need a little love in my life to motivate me, you know what I mean, so I can be inspired again.
You hear that, ladies?
Yeah, ladies. On the market. No. We'll see what happens. So, thanks for tuning in. This is your boy, Malcolm Riddle. You know how this goes. Domino, motherfucker.